Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. I'm Keith Bradshaw with the New York Times International Herald Tribune. I'll be your host today. Before I introduce our guest, I'd like to do our usual housekeeping. First of all, everybody, please pull out your mobiles now and turn them off, or at the very least, mute them. If everybody checks at the same time, nobody should be shy about doing so now, but please make sure they are off. They really ruin the sound quality. We've got a couple of outfits recording today. Second of all, I'd like to tell you about our upcoming speakers. On Thursday, we have Dr. Thitinan. He is a prominent political scientist from Thailand, and he'll be coming to Hong Kong to speak on Thailand's withdrawal symptoms, democracy and monarchy in transition. On the 25th, we have Kumi Naidu. He is the executive director of Greenpeace International, and he'll be coming to Hong Kong to talk about can China and other developing countries save the climate. On May 28th, we have Michael Palin. That sold out faster than anything I can remember, and apologies to those of you who may have tried. It literally sold out in under 1 minute. We actually went by the seconds past noon of the sign-up time for which emails were accepted for sign-up for that one. So we apologize if you tried to sign up or get on the waiting list for that one. Jerry Cohen is our next speaker. Many of you know him. It'll also be the week of his 80th birthday, one of the most famous American scholars on China for the past half century. So that'll be June 1st. Mark O'Neill, June 2nd. Speaking on the Tzu Chi Foundation, the largest nonprofit foundation in Greater China. And then finally, June 10th, we have Robert Sutter, a prominent American academic on China's rise. With that, I'd like to introduce our speaker today. Johan Bjorksten has been in China for 20 years. He's worked in a variety of capacities there, whether it is with a trading company, in the record and music industry, now with a PR consultancy. He's the author of the book on sale at the entrance to the room. He's worked with a variety of European companies in China, been very active in the European Chamber of Commerce. And with that, I'd like to introduce Johan Bjorksten. Thank you for coming.
Well, thank you very much, Keith, for your warm welcome. I'm extremely happy and grateful to be invited here to this, especially from the perspective of Beijing and Shanghai, is really a historic association and in an historic building. It's fantastic to be here with you today. I have to say I'm a little bit nervous in making a presentation like this to so many knowledgeable people who know so much about China. I see a lot of Chinese faces here today, and I see some business people, and so what can a Swede really tell you about doing business in China and promoting brands in a nationalistic China? And the ultimate reason also for apprehension is really that when I first came out with this book, the first question that everybody asked me was, why another business book about China? So not very good starting point right there. But I'd like to start out with a story that, you know, about 15 years ago, I was sitting with an old China hand, even at that time, Frederick Shou. He used to work for Bank Ando Suez and for a number of other banks in China. He's been around forever, Swedish guy. And we had a group of European parliamentarians asking about the business climate in China. And so they were asking us questions on, you know, everything from sort of business barriers to how to find people and so on. And then they asked Frederick, what are some of the most common mistakes that foreign companies, why do companies fail in China? And Frederick said, well, sometimes, you know, they haven't done their homework on the market, they haven't done proper analysis, they haven't found the right partner. He enumerated a dozen different reasons. And then the parliamentarian broke him off and said, but Frederick, you're really saying that these companies, it's their own fault. It's not because of trade barriers and other things. And Frederick said, yes, that's very much my point. And I think that may be perhaps a backdrop to the topic of today, you know, promoting brands in nationalistic China. Recently, the focus has very much been on the Chinese market clamping down, becoming less friendly to foreign companies and so on. And I'd like to give a little bit of perspective on that against the backdrop of this book. The reason that we wrote another business book about China is that basically when people asked us for recommendations, we could only find two kinds of business books. One was written by a businessman and very autobiographical, you know, Taming the Dragon kind of books, or My Adventures in the Chinese Hinterland. The other one was written more by academics and lacked a little bit of the sort of, you know, day-to-day operational things that we thought were very important to provide to everything from people who came as fresh managers to China, people back at head office. And we also wanted to see if we could find a few themes of strategies that always seem to work in China. And also, if you don't apply them, you seem to almost invariably fail. So just give you some examples of that. We wanted to write a very concrete handbook. So when it comes to headquarters, for example, I mean, trying to communicate with headquarters is one of the major problems of all of my clients, whether it's in a crisis situation or just in day-to-day normal business. I remember a lot of funny conversations with Western CFOs in particular. The thing that you've all heard about is fa piao, right? Try to tell a Western CFO that the first year's reimbursements in China cannot be tax deductible because they haven't used the right kind of receipt. Very problematic. But even worse is something called chops, right? You're all familiar with Chinese chops. I can see a lot of people nodding around the tables here. You know, when you tell a Western CFO about how Chinese chops function, they just say, no. And you say, well, this is how they work. No. You know, I've been in the business for 20 years. You're wrong. Cannot possibly be true. And that means that up till this day, I'm working daily with clients who don't have a chop policy in China. These are Fortune 500 companies that suddenly find that one of their local employees has taken out a loan for 100 million RMB, and nobody at head office knows about it. Because a chop is really an affidavit that you can use for a lot of different things, and it represents the person on the chop, which in many cases is the chairman of the board back in Europe or the US. Of course, there are other things that are more difficult to explain to head office as well. I had an irritated client call us a few years ago when we were renting a house in the French concession in Shanghai, and they couldn't get through to the office, and I tried to call the office as well, and I couldn't get through either, so I called on a mobile phone. And the lady who answered the phone said, yeah, I know. You know, we had a little problem yesterday. The rats ate our switchboard. So try to explain that to head office, if you will. The other thing is some of the myths that surround doing business in China. The first thing that a foreign executive getting off the airport in Beijing would hear is about guanxi. I.e., in China, if you have guanxi, you can do good business. If you don't have guanxi, you will not be able to do any business at all. And this is a very, very dangerous myth because, in my opinion, guanxi in China are more like the American sort of networking. You know, it's a way of getting to know people. When Europeans hear about this concept, they think about more the British old boys network. You have to be in an inside group, and if you're not inside that group, you will never be able to get in it and to reap the benefits of those guanxi. But guanxi is really about paying a lot of attention. If you go out eating with Chinese people, you'll find that they're extremely attentive to the people sitting around them at the table. They will see what you eat. They'll eat less of that so that you can have a little bit more. They will be filling your glass all the time and so on. And guanxi works much the same way. Once you've handed over a name card, that's a start of a relationship. It's not something you put in your drawer, but it's really something that you continue to work with. You send those little Christmas cards or New Year's cards, and you keep that relationship up. And why do I harp about this? Well, because over 20 years, and still today, I've seen so many cases where this is a major cause of failure in China for two reasons. First of all, there was a Swedish Fortune 500 multinational coming into China. They had a local consultant, a Swedish-Chinese person, who was very good friends with the CEO, or had won the trust of the Swedish CEO. And this person had excellent guanxi in China. How did he prove that? Because every time the CEO came to visit back in the 80s and the 90s, he could invite, you know, he could open doors to vice ministers and vice mayors and so on. Well, the problem was that at the time, China was extremely curious and welcoming to foreign business people. So if you had asked my secretary, without any guanxi whatsoever, to use the CEO of a Fortune 500 company as a door opener, she would have been able to set up those meetings. And the result was that this person could then tell the board of a Fortune 500 company that the Chinese government wants you to invest in this particular city with this particular partner. And because the Chinese government wanted that, so the company went ahead and started negotiations for a major factory. They put 30 expat families on the ground and started working to set up this factory, and they were promised the license would be forthcoming in December that year. Well, it became the Christmas present of the year for 5 or 6 years running. It was the running joke of the Swedish business community because they could never get this license. At the time, they were spending, you know, 200, 300. If you remember back in these days, in the 90s, having an expat in China meant hardship allowances. It meant having school allowances for the kids, drivers, free apartments, everything, you know, travel back to the home country 4 times a year. This was enormous money back then. And of course, after 5 or 6 years, it then transpires that the joint venture is not forthcoming. And what's more, this consultant, guess who's the owner of all the apartments that these guys have been renting in this town, right? I'm sure that he also had his hand in the pot with the drivers and with the schools and everything else that was going on there. So of course he had a great reason to be postponing this all the time and saying that the Chinese government wants you to do it in this way. So there's a very, very dangerous lesson, or important lesson to be learned here, which is that there is no such thing as the Chinese government from a business perspective. If you pick up any business book today, you'll see that it's about how the Chinese treat foreign companies, or the Chinese government treats foreign companies. You have to realize that China is a huge country, and we'll get back to that a little bit later. It's a continent. It's got lots of different factions jockeying for position. In China, there's always more than one choice. There's always more than one opportunity. And this is very, very important. If you look at what most business people say, and even in chambers of commerce, when we do the surveys, what is the biggest reason that companies fail in China? Competition. In many areas, China is one of the most open markets in the world, not just legally, but also because everybody wants to be there. Take one area, for example, household appliances. If you're an Electrolux, a Swedish company, you're not just competing about with the Europeans like Bosch, Siemens, and you know perhaps General Electric or Whirlpool as in Europe, but you're also competing against LG and Samsung. You're competing against Toshiba and Panasonic, National Panasonic from Japan, and about 100 local brands in China. So if you cannot take market share, it's not because China, in this industry at least, is a closed economy, but because the competition is so fierce. And I think that's also something that's important to remember. Another sort of hands-on thing that we try to talk about in the book are mundane issues like language. I would say that language is the most underestimated management challenge in China to this day. If you, for example, pick up, there are no good translations, basically, between English and Chinese in business. If you pick up Philip Kotler's books, Marketing Management, the book that we've all read in business school all over the world, well, Chinese students are reading the same book, except it's been translated by professors at Beijing University who were brought up in the planned economy. So it's not Philip Kotler's book. It's a totally different book. They're reading an interpretation by a bunch of guys who grew up in the planned economy of Philip Kotler's thinking. So, and I'll just illustrate this with one case from my own experience. We had a big management change in a Fortune 500 company. There was a British guy coming in, and you know, are there any Brits here today? I suppose there are. Yeah, well, we all know Brits are very eloquent, right? So this guy wanted, as his first thing to do, was to hold a speech to the troops. Johan, I want to hold a speech to the troops. And I said, okay, so we set that up, and we had about 200 of his middle managers coming in. And then he was speaking in this very flowery language. He was saying things, it was a very, very good speech. He was saying things like, so, my friends, how will we know that we have succeeded in China? We will know that we have succeeded in China when consumers buy our products at a 20% markup to the competition. We will know that we have succeeded in China when a headhunter calls you every week and offers you a 30% higher salary, and you still remain with our company. Translation. So, my friends, do you believe that we can succeed in China? Do you really believe that we can sell our products at a 20% markup compared to the competition? Well, if you don't believe that and a headhunter offers you a 30% salary, I suggest you leave the company. So, my friends, What do I want you to tell your people when you leave this room? You're all middle managers here. What do I want you to tell your people when you leave this room? I want you to tell your people that we can and will be successful in China. I want you to tell your people, translation. So if you don't believe what I've been saying here, and you know, you don't think that you can tell this to your people, I suggest that you leave this room right now. At that point, I got up on the stage and said, that's not what he's saying. This was being translated by a woman who speaks excellent English, his HR director, and she was sort of projecting her own worst fears of her new boss into this whole translation. And this happens day after day after day. It doesn't make things easier that in China you use 10,000 as the basic unit of counting, right? So I've also heard very interesting translations for Volvo, for example, when the translator was saying, Volvo manufactures 327 million trucks a year. No. 327 trucks a year. No. It's the way it goes. So language really needs to be managed. And there are ways, there are operational ways of really making sure that you can work with a translator in a better way, keeping people involved. In my own company, I found that the only way that we can really make good translations of sensitive and key and critical issues, such as, for example, mission statements, vision statements, and so on, is to have a team of multicultural people sitting down together, native speakers of English, native speakers of Chinese, and then them ironing out this translation, what the real value of it should be. Finally, I'd like to touch on the third point that I said, which is strategy. Are there some things that seem to work in China all the time, and some things that seem to doom you to failure if you fail to apply them? Well, one of the things that we always hear is, we have to be in China. This is a typical sort of Western boardroom comment. China is the biggest market in the world, we have to be in China. I think that's wrong. I think that's a very difficult or problematic statement to say. I think that every company in the world needs to have a China strategy today. I've been working with a couple of highly specialized companies in the steel industry. They make some of the equipment for processing extremely high quality steel. They've been alone on that market. It's a German company and a Swedish company have more or less split the market over the last 50 years. In the last 18 months, three Chinese competitors have come onto the world stage with products at half the price and that are basically equally good. So you have to have a China strategy. That does not mean you necessarily have to be in China. And why do I say that? Well, first of all, what is China? Again, China is not, from a business perspective, a country, it's a continent. If you just look at the geographics of this country, the choice between for consumers in different parts of the country are totally different. We've worked a lot with Omega. I'll use Omega as an example. They sell watches, the Switch watches, right? So what do people across the border in Guangzhou want to buy? They're a little bit more sporty. They're sort of down to earth. They want a nice watch when they spend a lot of money, but they don't want to spend too much money. So it's the Seamaster and the Speedmaster. Those are the hottest watches in Guangzhou. And we put on a nice dance show with some Hong Kong star, you know, sell a lot of watches after that. In Shanghai, what did we do? We used Miss Switzerland and Simon Yam, Ren Dahua, who's a famous B actor, he always plays the crook in Chinese movies, right? Second day, in comes a guy with his wife or something, and says, you know, honey, which one do you like? She said, that one is really nice. The guy picks up a big bag of money, 720,000 Chinese yuan, and buys the watch for cash. That's Shanghai consumption to me. It's like as many diamonds per square millimeter that you can fit into that watch. This is the criterion for Chinese consumers in Shanghai. In northern China, it's more like where I come from in northern Sweden. You know, men are real men. We like to hunt animals, or rather kill them with our bare hands if we can, if they're small. And when somebody in Manchuria buys a watch, an expensive watch, they want it to show, right? So it's a big gold piece. They come out of the store sort of, look back. So this is really not one market, it's several markets at once. And our more sophisticated consumer clients are dividing China into some 20 different segments. McKinsey just did a very interesting study where they cluster Chinese cities and show, for example, how huge the differences are between cities that are very close to each other geographically, such as Shenzhen and Guangzhou. The demographics are just totally different. The other thing that seems to be important when you enter China is to consider top-heavy investment. We were talking about that earlier in the discussion here at the table as well. Either you go for it or you don't. There's no such thing as a sort of half-done deal in China. And the reason for that, I think, is you really need to put in a lot of people and you need to put in the best people. I'll give you two examples there. The first one, when I was part of setting up IKEA in China, they had on site for the Beijing store 100 people working on setting up that, 100 expatriate people setting up that store for 200 locally employed rookies, which means that basically every freshman in this company had a half-time coach from somebody who was very familiar with the organization. That means that today, as they're rolling out all over China, they have, you know, literally hundreds of people that they can put in managerial positions around the country. And some of them are now store managers, which means that they're in charge of an entire region in China. The opposite of that is working with another large company that had just purchased or acquired a 3,000 employee state-owned enterprise in a second-tier city in China. They sent out one guy. It was one of the best factory managers in the entire group. He came to this city and he started work. And he'd opened factories all over the world before. Well, I was on a con call every second week with him in something we call the China Marketing Group. And we were, you know, discussing progress. First 2 weeks, fine. Second 2 weeks, fine. 6 weeks down the line, yeah. We're hitting a few snags, but things are going pretty well. Three months down the line, yeah, we're having problem with almost everything on the to-do list, basically. 6 months later, the board of directors start getting worried and send more people out. So the costs are increasing and things are going, still not really progressing. The whole thing was delayed about 18 months, and the company is still suffering from the aftershocks of this 10 years later in China. They never really made it into the Chinese market, and I would say that it's totally tied to this one thing. It sapped the whole strength of the organization. There's no way that a single Western factory manager can turn around a company of 3,000 state-owned employees in the rural hinterland of China, and that's a key lesson to be drawn as well. Why is it so difficult? Why is it so important to have top-heavy investment? Well, that's because of the importance of corporate culture. I was reading an Economist article, I think it was 3 years ago, where they counted how many licensed accountants are available throughout China. They said something like 60,000 in a country that needs about 500,000 certified accountants. Well, the same thing is true in my own industry. We're growing as an industry, the public relations industry, by maybe 30% a year. The Chinese economy is growing at 10% a year. And where do our clients get their communications managers? Of course, they hire them from PR agencies like my own. So we're losing about 10% into the overall growth of China. And then let's just, for the sake of argument, assume that 10% leave the industry and do an MBA or in a dynamic marketplace like China, find something else to do. So we need 50% new consultants per year. What does that mean? If we as an industry hire 1,000 people year one, we have 500 people with 1 year of industry experience to manage them. We have 250 with 2 years of experience. If you're good at math, we have one person with 10 years of experience to manage 1,000 rookies. I don't think that happens in any other market around the world. And that means that you have an extreme salary curve because these people are so valuable. Somebody who started in my company at 3,500 RMB 8 years ago now, is now making 60,000 RMB. And as you know, the tax is not very progressive, so that really means that they've almost 15-tupled their salary in 7 or 8 years. And that means that if you want to bring people into an organization very fast, you really need to build corporate culture. And corporate culture, like Guanxi, is one of those really wishy-washy concepts that I hate, right? You know, what is corporate culture? Well, there are operational ways to work with corporate culture. And again, I'll give you an example from my own industry. When I was trying to build a good consulting company in China, one of my biggest problems was that my employees would not question things. They would not challenge authority. They would sit there and take notes when I was presenting the media plan for the Monday. Yeah, we're almost finished. And so I said we're a participatory management team. Everybody should have an opinion. You know, do you have any questions on the media plan? Okay, what do you think? Pretty good. So in the end, we chose to use what I call directing or staged Monday meetings. I chose two of the most junior consultants and asked them to challenge me as I was presenting the plan. So Molly, 21 years old, I think that plan is totally wrong. 20 people, nobody dares to meet the eyes of anybody else. After a few weeks, we had a very lively conversation going on, because every week we did this, and it was difficult to get it started in the beginning. But after a while, you could actually have a totally different environment in the company. And at that time, we then brought it up to the surface and said, this 6 weeks ago, remember when Molly put her hand up? It was staged. So what is the what is the reason that we did that? It's because we want the kind of discussion that we have today in the company. So this was one way of very operationally working with corporate culture. And now I'd like to just finish by talking about nationalistic brands and why, you know, what we should be doing in China. And I think that this corporate culture ties into another very, very different, difficult and important topic, which is corruption. We've all read about the Rio Tinto scandal. I'm worried about the fact that so many business executives, Western business executives, will talk about bribery and other unethical behavior in China as if it were a fact of the world. And remember I said earlier, in China you always have a choice. No matter what industry you're in, you can choose whether or not you want to play by a certain set of rules or whether you want to maintain your own integrity as a Western company. And I think this is very, very important to remember. Is China becoming, you know, because of issues like the Rio Tinto scandal, becoming more averse to foreign investment? Is China becoming a more difficult place to do business in? I would argue that China is actually trying to create a more level playing field today. Remember that 10, 15, 20 years ago, when Western companies were entering China, we received a lot of tax breaks, a lot of benefits, a lot of things that would make it easier to enter this very difficult market. Today, China is no longer so difficult, which means that as the playing field is becoming more level, it is difficult for Western companies to adapt to that. Because Western or local companies, of course, will act in a more sort of grassroots fashion. They will have a better understanding of the market, they will be faster in the market, and they may also have better connections in Guangxi. But I would argue that most of this are things that Western companies can mimic and Western companies can build. Is China becoming more nationalistic? There's certainly more choice today. Chinese companies are doing better. Chinese companies are becoming much more professional. And since everybody from the Western world is already in China, the Chinese consumer can really pick from what the world has to offer. And I'd just like to finish those comments on another note, which is everything that we've talked about in this book is trying to make these issues very, very hands-on and operational. And I think that when we're looking at the business climate today, we need to be looking at what can we as business people do to function in a China that's maturing, that's becoming more sophisticated, and thus in some instances becoming more difficult for foreigners to do business in. I think if you look at a number of areas such as communications, how sophisticated Western companies are about doing lobbying and communications in China, or rather their lack of sophistication in doing so, having an accurate macro analysis, working with internal communications with their own employees. I think there are a lot of areas that we can improve very quickly, and if we're just benchmarking against our home markets in the US and Europe. So my conclusion would be, if companies try to apply the same ethics, the same sophisticated methodologies and business practices that they do on their home markets in China, I think that they can indeed market their brands even in a very nationalistic China. Thank you very much for your attention.
So if you'd like, you can stay there for questions. And just to have a first question, how should companies be improving sophistication of their lobbying? Often lobbying has been one of the trickiest areas to handle in an ethical, honest way.
Right. Well, if you look at some specific cases, let's take major mergers and acquisitions deals in China. It's been interesting to note how little the professionals within the companies themselves have really known about what's going on. In the West, let's say that in my own company, country, Sweden, we had a national icon, Absolut Vodka. You've all tried it, which was recently acquired by Pernod Ricard, and I was somewhat involved in that communications process. We had the CEO of Pernod Ricard in the fields in Sweden, smelling the local produce, you know, really showing that he would care for this company just as if he were a Swedish CEO. Now, I don't see anything of that going on with Western companies trying to make acquisitions in China. It's in one case where there's a major deal 2 years ago that went astray and didn't come through. The PR department and the communications professional in the company knew about this the day before the announcement of the deal, which means that there was no preparation whatsoever, and the deal faltered because of grassroots opposition on nationalist grounds. This was a famous, iconic Chinese brand, and there was a netizen revolt against selling it to a foreign owner. So this would be one such example. And lobbying, of course, is more than just about the smoke-filled room. It's about sophisticated communications in society in general. Don't think that just because China doesn't have freedom of the press, it doesn't have a lively internal debate. Go on to some of the best chat rooms, look in some of the best magazines, and you will find that almost anything can be and is discussed there, which means that you really need to apply the same kind of sophisticated methodologies that you would at home.
Who else would like Francis?
Francis Moriarty, RDHK. I just wanted to follow on that point regarding the internet. How are you dealing, or how do you think companies should deal with the internet? Because it seems extremely easy for somebody to launch an internet or microblog or SMS attack or campaign of any sort quite easily.
This is a very, very interesting question, and actually something that I've been working on more or less full time for the last 3 years. I've been spearheading our own effort online to try to help clients, and it was disturbing how difficult it was 3 years ago to convince clients to be honest online. In China, there's been a lot of what's called astroturfing and negative campaigning, which means that you hire a bunch of school kids to write positive comments about your company or product online. And this has been the standard fare of a lot of local companies, but more worryingly also of Western companies who thereby totally disregard their own ethical standards worldwide. And some of them have had a lot of blowback from that. So we could not, 3 years ago, sell in our offering on the grounds we were trying to sell it in as a purely ethical offering. We want to engage stakeholders online under our real identities, having real discussions with them. And our clients would say, well, you know, how can we be sure that you're not going to have negative comments? Of course you can't be sure. There are going to be negative comments. That's the whole point. You're having a discussion with somebody. You're engaging people like people. Now, after some of the crises that have happened because of this way of working, we now have a much better market for our services. And lots of companies are hiring my company to work online with building that kind of rapport and real discussion with Chinese consumers, rather than trying to hoodwink them by massive spamming, as it were. So I think that applying ethical standards, I think being a bit daring, trying to go out on a limb and do things before they're purely measurable. We always have a lot of clients saying, well, what should we be doing online? And 3 years ago, we'd say, start a corporate blog. And then they'd agonize, well, what if somebody posts a negative comment on the blog? What if we don't? What if, what if, what if? And then 3 years later now, they'll come and say, Johan, we've thought about this. We want to start our corporate blog. Well, the problem is nobody reads blogs anymore. So the same thing is, you should be on Twitter. Well, why? What if somebody writes a negative comment on Twitter? So it's the same story time and time again. I think the companies that win online in China are really the ones that dare to do things a little bit differently and be a bit early adopters and experiment as they go along. I think that this is an extremely fast-moving environment. I think it's dangerous for companies not to be online because there are negative campaigns and you really need to understand what happens. In my estimation, about 90% of all 85-90% of all major media crises in China last year started online. So there was something boiling there for a while, and then all of a sudden it gets into a mainline newspaper article on the Chinese mainland, and then it explodes both online and in the press. But it's always been online first.
here, please. Please identify yourselves.
Hi, I'm Paul Hicks from Grebstedt Hicks Communications. We also have a PR agency, and we set up a branch in China recently. One of the things that we were told about before coming in was that it's common practice for agencies to pay the media for stories or transportation fees and so on. And that was something that we felt jarred with the professional standards that we're used to outside. I just wondered what your view on that was, whether you feel that's something that companies should do differently if it's not what they've done before, or whether it's something you have to do because it's what's done in China.
Well, there are two different levels of paying. You mentioned two things, paying for coverage, and the other one is paying what's called taxi reimbursements. And of course, everybody knows that it's not going to cost you 200 kwai to take that taxi. Maybe it's 70 kwai, and you know the 130 goes into your pocket. I think most agencies have taken the decision, and this has been supported by the China International PR Association, to say that taxi reimbursements are okay. This was more viable a few years ago because journalists had very, very low pay, and they would not have been able to afford a lot of the, actually wouldn't have been able to afford the taxi fare. Now, that's changing, and we're seeing some Chinese journals that are saying, we do not allow our journalists to take taxi reimbursements. So that's, as the Chinese media are becoming more professional, it also means that the ethical standards are going up. If you take the other question, paying for coverage, I think that is very worrisome. It's illegal in China, as everywhere else. It's technically a bribe, and every year one or more journalists get prosecuted for it in Chinese courts, get sued by companies or by their magazines. So I would say that that is something that one should be very, very careful before doing.
We have time for one more. Back here, please.
David Ketchum from Byte Communications. I've been watching the Indigenous Innovation Certificate evolving in China. So the Chinese government, to become a Chinese vendor, a company needs to prove that the IP is held by a Chinese company and is based on Chinese innovation or self-innovation before you can market or sell your services to the Chinese government. So in that, that's not just nationalistic, right? That's a protectionist barrier of some sort. What's the role of communications in that mix, and how would you advise a technology company who wasn't able to compete for some contracts perhaps that they had previously to proceed?
I haven't looked at that issue, so I'm not in a position to answer really. I think in every market there are going to be technical barriers, and certainly China is no exception. There are many technical barriers in many fields. The point I was trying to make more is that instead of focusing on what we cannot do, we need to focus more as business people on what we can do and how we can get around those obstacles. I think the issue that you're talking about here would really need a concerted lobbying and communications drive by a lot of different companies at the same time, such as the Business Software Alliance or something like that.
Thank you all, and we always like to give our guests something to remember the club by. You warm in Beijing. Thank you very much.
Thank you
very
much. Thank you.
And thank you all for coming. Hope to see some of you on Thursday on the Thai Monarchy Democracy Transition. Thank you. Mm-hmm.